were being successful or really were successful had specialized. They weren't all things to all people. They weren't trying to own the entire world. They just were going to be very, very good at one part of the market that they could approach. And they might innovate, and they might expand themselves, and their business might move forward or morph as time progressed. But they were really focused. So there was a core part of their business that was very, very strong. And although they might have other ventures, other revenues, avenues of revenue and so on, they really had one way or had become specialists. And so I sat back and I said, you know, what really do I want to do? And, you know, what do I want to be really, really good at? What would I enjoy? And, you know, really pushing myself to think about what I want to do. And at that point, you know, I started hearing all these things about work on the business instead of in the business, and mm-hmm. It didn't mean a whole lot to me. I didn't really understand what it meant. But I started sitting down for the first time and saying, okay, instead of just going out there and doing stuff, what is it that I want to be a rock star at, basically? And I decided that I have this thing for international work. For some reason, I just thought international business found fascinating and really interesting and really exciting. Mm-hmm. Never done it before in my life. I mean, I traveled when I was a kid with my parents, and I'd lived in other countries, but I'd never sold anything international.
It just sounded glamorous.
But it sounded cool, yeah. So I decided that's what I was going to do, and I figured the best place to start, because the dot-com industry was still relatively hot, was to go and try that industry, try that market.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. I approached a company and said, you know what, I want to help you expand and your software internationally. And perhaps by luck, perhaps by timing, perhaps, you know, just like what happened with you earlier in our conversation, just things are the right place at the right time, they said, sure. And I knew almost nothing about technology, really, at a deep level. I had done some projects for some, you know, training center of the technology, and for a retail computer store, I'd done some work. So I knew a little bit, but I didn't know anything about the software.
Well, what was this company?
This company was a business process automation company.
So they sold software that...
Software. Yeah, automates business processes. And so they gave me a shot. Again, you know, lots at that point I learned about risk reversal and so on, so I was willing to take on a fairly big part of the risk by making it really inexpensive for them to do it and basically have some milestones in place throughout the process. They could say, hey, you know what, Christian, it's just not working out. But I had made the determination at that point, I was learning a lot more about marketing at the time too, that this was going to be what I was going to be really, really good at. And over the years, as I was looking more and more at some of these people who had been successful, you know, and even today, you know, I look at guys that do a fairly good job, like David Frey and, mm-hmm. and Jeff Paul and all these other guys that are out there. They always started out with the spa business or the carpet cleaning business, like Joe Polish, mm-hmm. or financial planning business. They became really, really good in one area and milked that, put processes in place and so on. And I said, and it kind of struck me that, you know what, I could probably work along this line here in this market. And I couldn't find anybody else doing it.
All right, so this company, they weren't selling internationally. They were just selling nationally?
That's right. They were just selling within North America.
Then how much did the software sell for?
Range of price from $10,000 to $500,000.
So it was high-end stuff.
It's high-end stuff, yeah.
And what kind of deal did you negotiate with them?
So a monthly fee, monthly retainer fee, if you want to call it that, and 10% of whatever I sold, and milestones. So, you know, every 3 months I had to be basically achieve stuff
mm-hmm.
For them, and if not, they had the right to cancel. So, you know, I began to dig deep into all these guys that have these marketing processes, everything that I could learn, anything I could do, and really began to systematize the way that I went to market.
Mm-hmm.
And soon enough, international was generating more business than the national domestic team. So one guy selling international selling more than five guys in North America.
You tell me the story. What happened?
Basically, it boils down to, one, what are the different avenues that you can go to market with? And I'll explain a little further along what processes I've developed along the way to make myself effective, I guess, as an organization, then how I started building my company. But I was looking at, well, what's the shortest path to market? Obviously, in international markets, distribution channels are very, very important. Channel resellers or value-added resellers or system integrators for the software industry were critical. So the first question was, how do you get these people to be interested in what you've got to offer?
Mm-hmm.
So one, you had to be able to prove to these companies that really basically work on commission for another company reselling their software, because
mm-hmm.
They don't get paid unless they sell the software, and then of course they get the margins, and they get the system integration work that comes with it, or value-added services. So you really had to have a good case. So one, we had to prove that we could generate leads for these companies. The second aspect is we have to be able to find these companies and recruit them and convince them to come on board, considering that the whole market is cluttered. In the space that I was playing, there was 144 different competitors that could offer a similar type of product, perhaps not as good, not as strong, or not as capable as the one that, you know, I felt I was offering. But still, there's a lot of clutter that these companies had to wade through and see, you know, which one is actually going to be the best partner. So the first thing I needed to prove was that it could be sold. You know, using the phone is really the only mechanism. This company did not have the cash flow to justify lots of international travel up front. I had to prove that this stuff could be sold. So one is identifying the best market, the best target market.
Mm-hmm.
Who was an easy shot? Who were companies that needed it? Who had big pains and big problems? So that was the first piece, was identifying that. So doing a bit of research, doing some call to potential companies that might be probable avenues for selling, you begin to learn a lot, you know, without having to actually go and try selling something. Just call them up and say, you know what, if you were to ever buy a product like this, what would it be? What would it look like? What would it have? What would you worry about knowing? How important is this, 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 and this, and what kind of things are important to you?
Mm-hmm.
And then calling the company back 2 days later and talking to somebody completely different, because in a sale, there's always multiple people involved in an enterprise organization. There might be the purchasing organization, there might be the technical team, there might be a line of business manager, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to only call a handful of companies to really start understanding, hey, you know what, there is a baseline here of information that is required. So then going back and formulating information that met those requirements, and then really going back and stepping back and taking a broader approach, and how can the information I provide them be of so much value that they begin to see me as an expert, somebody that can give them advice in approaching the topic or the subject that I'm trying to sell them on. So it wasn't about me trying to sell them a product, it was about me trying to sell them time or a meeting so they could learn a whole lot about what it takes to buy a product. So really the educational approach, which in my opinion is the most valuable approach in selling any type of product. And then religiously, you know, following up, finding different ways to add value to the conversation, using lots of technology tools like webinars and conference calls and so on.
Were you using that stuff?
Yeah, I was. And becoming very, very proficient at it. So once I figured out this first company, you know, the approach to go through it, and then, of course, creating all these contacts in international and beginning to get some momentum, then it was, okay, let's find another company. I think I now have a process where I can walk a company through. But I was very particular. I focused, for example, only on Microsoft-based technologies, companies that build stuff around Microsoft technology, so I can reuse the channel, the leveraged relationships in the market. And then I became very good at recruiting and finding companies that wanted to expand, you know, by using messages in the market, like if over 50% of your business comes from North America, your business could be in serious risk. Showing statistical evidence as to why larger companies always make it a point to ensure that 50 or 60% of their business or more comes from international markets, because it provides diversification, provides cash flow during slow seasons in North America, and so on and so forth, right? So I became very proficient in finding customers. I had developed a methodology for myself where I could, you know, easily test to see if I can get these companies to market. I could put them through similar distribution channel and relationships I had in other places. And then, you know, because I was doing 6 or 7 companies or 8 companies at a time, I could leverage one trip to do a whole bunch of things. So saving a lot of companies a lot of money, a lot of energy, in something that they may not have been able to do on their own or would have to have paid considerably more to.
So you were still working with that one company, but you had multiple.
Yeah, they were all contracts, right? I took all these works on as contract, as a subcontract to the business, or as a contract to the business. With all of them having an understanding that it was my intention to do multiple companies, that they would never compete against each other, that were complementary.
You were representing multiple companies.
That's correct.
If you had an international contact, say a company in Australia that may be a good fit for your business software, you had other complementary products that you could sell that same company once you're in.
That's right.
And that was your strategy, to have multiple things to sell to one client.
That's correct.
That's excellent. Give me an example. How much of your product line could be a potential sale to the one company you get internationally?
A distributor. So I would look at distributors, regional resellers, and so on. So I set up this whole network of contacts worldwide that I have now, where I could basically take a company, a software company from California or from Washington or from Calgary, Canada, and I could plug them into this process where I could identify where they fit into the market. I could easily call my distribution network now and then determine, you know, when customers would be interested in. We could test and ensure what would be involved. I had now, you know, after many years of doing this, have experience in knowing what the legal requirements are for getting products into markets and, you know, IP protection and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I made sure that, okay, if I sold this product in my distribution channel, what's the next thing the customer always wanted to buy? And if they wanted to buy XYZ, or if I saw them buying another product, or if I was involved in, or one of the resellers that I work with was involved in an RFP, a request for a proposal,
mm-hmm.
that also involved a complementary product that I didn't distribute or represent, I would simply call that company up and say, hey, what's your international go-to-market position? How do you do it? Are you having success? I see that you're, you know, in these opportunities. How are you being represented? You know, who are your resellers and so on and so forth? And after a while, you begin to get known within the market as being the guy that knows how to do certain things. And, you know, your resellers recommend you to the companies that are dealing with them. Partners, they work a lot together in the Microsoft space. Everybody sees each other at global trade shows or regional trade shows. So
mm-hmm.
you really begin to own the market. And I became very, very consistent at, you know, not only for the software market, but the system integrators worldwide to be sending them information. And if I thought there were ways that they could sell their product better or they could run their business better, I'd find ways to be the guy that would provide that advice for free. But I remained or stay top of mind with many of these organizations.
Is this what you're doing today still?
So I would be doing multiple software companies at a time.
Mm-hmm.
With time, you begin to really increase your fees. And I started to develop my own little staff of people within you know, the organization of doing it. So some organizations really, you know, didn't want to hire internally. They wanted me to basically keep the whole thing on, so I would hire people who would become, you know, international sales reps for a company or two companies so that I could leverage it, you know, greater and greater.
But it would be your company.
But it was my company.
But the sales rep was, they would rep just the...
Exactly.
Okay.
So they would work for me. But over time, through this process, I started developing my own methodology for, you know, going to market. And as I sat back and I stripped it down, really the principles that I'd collected from all these people I'd talked to, from these gurus in the industry who are brilliant at marketing or sales, and I started putting it, and I think, how do I put this into buckets of information so that it's easy for me to reference? So I started building a spreadsheet and a database of information, and I used some of other people's software in the process to help automate some of this. But how do I get through making sure that I don't miss any steps? That, you know, I don't forget to put a risk reversal offer. I don't forget to calculate lifetime value. I don't forget to determine, you know, what my stadium pitch is going to be for the client and so on and so forth, right? All these different components. So I have had them all written down. I had friends who owned businesses or sometimes these same people that I had stayed in touch with would see that, you know, I had some pretty good ideas on expanding businesses or selling stuff. But they would come back a few years later and say, Christian, you know, what is it you're doing that's working? Can I talk to you a little bit now and see what you're up to? And, of course, I always make sure that you stay in touch with your contacts, of course, right? And I realized that, hey, if I strip down the technology-related questions, you know, how is your technology built, so on and so forth, and substitute with more generic questions, this really applies to a lot of other businesses. So I ended up doing what, you know, a lot of other, you know, people who perhaps went into marketing have done, is they start looking at, well, what other industries can I do the same thing for? And there came a point a couple of years ago where I didn't want to travel as much. I have more miles collected than a lot of people I know. So I said, you know, can I do this locally? Can this happen with other businesses? And in the process, you know, I become much better at negotiating and much better at selling myself and my products and my services. So I started approaching a couple of local companies and a few that interested me quite a bit, and started making deals that I could, they were looking at getting out of their business, they wanted to retire in particular, I could make a deal where, you know, by increasing their sales, I would have an equity stake and then I could buy the rest of their company out.
All right, well, can we talk about a specific one?
Sure. There's a, you know, I own a training center now, for example.
What kind of training center?
They do training on, in this case, they do technical training, soft skills such as, time management and presentation skills, those kind of things.
The people that's come in for live trainings?
That's live training as an instructor. And at the same time, they also do office training, so Microsoft, PowerPoint, Word, Excel. We do all that kind of training throughout the process. And this business had been, you know, chugging along, doing all right. Technology, focus mainly as well, though they have the soft skills, is really to support or complement the technology piece.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat back and I looked at them and I said, you know what, I think I could do a really good job for this company. But I couldn't find any, you know, guru in the market who had put together a marketing program for training centers. So I said, hey, I'll try to give a shot at this. By understanding the why, by getting down to the real reasons why he wanted to increase his sales and increase his business, I understand that really what he wanted to do was retire. And wanting to retire for many years, and now he had a 5-year target, but at the rate his business was going, there wasn't going to be enough cash in the business to do so. And I said, well, I can't make you really any promises because, you know, I don't know exactly how your business will work and should work, but I'll give it my best shot and I'll make it very, very easy for us to do business. And I basically put a full guarantee that if within a period of time I didn't produce X number of results for him, that he really wouldn't have to pay me anything. It was, at this point, it was a bit of a challenge for myself and a bit of a hobby. I wasn't starving for cash like I was a number of years ago. And then, you know, after digging a little further is, you know, what do you want to do with the business and how much would it take to buy the business? Or if somebody would offer you cash, what would you accept for the business? He gave me the figure for the company. And although I was in a position at the time to buy it outright, I said, what if I produce that in sales and then some? Would you just flip it over, give it to me?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, absolutely. The money is there. I don't care where the money comes from, but it's money that we wouldn't have had in the past. So go for it. So again, I went in, and the methodology that I've developed around the process that works for me.
Did you do a contract? Did you go to an attorney? Or what?
Yeah, I went to an attorney. I think there's a couple of things that, you know, along the way you learn. There's one, whatever it costs to spend money with a lawyer to do something right, spend the money with the lawyer to do it right. A lot of people try to do it on their own ad hoc.
Right.
You know, you can save a lot of time or a lot of money by doing it on your own,
mm-hmm.
but you'll never, if you ever face a situation with grief or challenges, if you've done it right, you save yourself a lot of headaches.
Right. So with this particular deal, did you and him meet at the attorney's office to nail this down?
Yeah, well, what I did is, because I do a lot of contracts
mm-hmm.
for my consulting software expansion business, if you want to call it that,
mm-hmm.
I do have access to a lawyer that I maintain on retainer. So I simply had him draft an agreement, take it to him. He had it reviewed by his lawyer. Two lawyers duked it out and came to an agreement that we both liked. So it was fair, you know, it wasn't long, it wasn't complex, anything outrageous, but we made sure that it was fair and we understood. And at the same time, I was willing to take on a lot of the risk for the 12 months, you know, and basically I could make a lot of money for him, but if I didn't hit the targets that we wanted, then he'd walk away. I wanted it to be very, very easy for him. At the same time, I wanted really to put my process to the test. Do I really have something that works, or or am I just lucky? Because luck is a big factor. I've learned in a lot of things sometimes. And in going through the process that I developed really boils down to first defining a strategy. These experts will tell you to do the next, and then strategy by determining shortest path, by testing, you know, what it is that the market wants, by doing proper market research, by asking the right questions, by, you know, really understanding what the best way or best ways look to be for going to market. And once you've tested it and you feel comfortable that you're on a winning path, the next step is alignment. You really need to get every part of the business pulling or pushing or whatever the case may be in the same direction. So the way the salespeople act and talk and what they say in the presentations they do, you know, all centered around you know, your unique selling proposition or the ultimate strategic position you want to take in the market, the way the receptionist greets and handles people, all these different things, the marketing, of course, direct response advertising, all those components to the way the classes are held and run, the flexibility of scheduling, all the things that were important, we just start making sure that we're lined up with what customers actually matter to the customer.
Okay. How many employees were there?
At the time, there were 9 employees, and most of the instructors were contractors, so about 12 contractors or instructors on contract, so we weren't required to pay them every week if there wasn't work for them to do. But you pay a premium in the event they're not there. So once we have things in alignment, we have people moving in the same direction, the next stage is growth, you know, really getting, putting the machine to work and you know, franchising, for lack of a better term, in everything you do. So it was very easy to bring in a salesperson because you knew that this was the lead generation call that they had to make. This is what they made to an industry. This is the offer that they made. They weren't trying to sell them the class up front. They're trying to get them educated. We had seminars going on every week, and we still do, that, you know, educate the market on the value of training and on specific subjects like time management and how to be more effective as a leader or as a boss, or and how to reduce your help desk cost if you're a large organization with a large help desk. Bring in experts again to cover these subjects and these topics consistently. And then, of course, offers. Every month there's some offer, some promotion, there's some gimmick, there's some event going on to keep people excited about what's happening. Mm-hmm. And then turning the industry on its tables by doing non-traditional things, bundling programs that never would have been bundled before. So if you want to take a technical course, you have to take an effective presentation course. You want to take an Outlook class on how to use Outlook, Microsoft Outlook, you have to take a time management class as a bundle or whatever, or value-added service. So it became harder and harder for the competition to keep up and play in the same space, because value for dollar, although, you know, we never discounted, we never, you know, offered really, really cheap training, our prices really, you know, we're never the cheapest of the bunch. Value for dollar and the guarantees that we're willing to offer, much higher than anybody else's. And so apples to apples was not the comparison people had to make a decision on anymore. And then over a period of time, of course, a period of about 7 months, business begins to ramp and grow and things start to move. Business just starts to flow through the doors like never before. And in the training industry, it's very much, I looked outside the industry to what other organizations do that have inventory that expires every night, like restaurants, like airlines, like hotels, what did they do? And we start implementing similar strategies and tactics that those industries utilize to ensure that their facilities are full.
Yeah, give me a couple examples that really worked well.
Aeroplan type programs for the airlines are very, very effective. For the airline industry, they keep people very loyal, so we implemented one of those.
Mm-hmm.
For gym, we implemented a membership program like gyms do, where gyms have, of course, you know, inventory that expires every night as well. So we implemented a membership program that had a whole bunch of benefits. You sign up up front, which creates instant cash flow for your organization. We implemented travel in Europe. You can buy a Europass for the train. We implemented a pass where you could buy multiple programs in one shot, or basically you can take unlimited training for a year at a fixed rate, except for cost of courseware. Components like those really change the way people view it. So somebody would say, hey, well, I was thinking of taking two courses this year, but if I pay $1,000 more or X dollars more, I can actually take a whole bunch more classes, and all I have to pay for is the books. And they would jump on it. And then, of course, we'd have the cash up front.
Were the classes all day long or just night only?
We have classes all the time. We have weekend classes, evening classes, day classes. They're all over the board. We really market to the business community, not to the individual user.
So who ends up paying for it? The business owner?
The business owner.
He writes it off. He pays his employees to go.
That's right. Really, our approach to the market was by educating companies that if you do invest in training, a lot of the training that companies invest in is very ineffective. In fact, most companies will get a return on investment of about $2 for every dollar in training that they spend. And most people actually are the same. So, you know, if you or I were to buy a $400 book from one of these experts, in most cases, most people will only get $800 worth of value out of the book back. Because at the end of the day, you might only read it once. You may not know how to implement it. It may be out of your actionable ability to understand what you actually have to do with the information, as an example. So we started educating the company, you know, their clients or the market in general, that there are companies out there that get up to a $26 return on investment. So for every dollar they spend, they're getting 26 bucks back, which is, you know, companies like Xerox, for example. So they'll spend $1,000 or $10,000 getting somebody up to speed, but they know they're getting $26,000 or dollars back in return, because they have a process and a way to make sure that the training is effective. And we implemented similar systems to help reinforce, to help validate, to help ensure that, you know, the training didn't go out the door as soon as the person left the classroom. Get a huge amount of what you learn in a day anyways. So we started doing things that really ensured that people got lots of value out of the programs that they do invest in. And by taking that bit of a higher road approach, it really helped, you know, ensure that people saw the value that they were getting and understand, you know, that if they took training with us, really we're going to ensure that that training was actionable and they could do something with it in their life to make their business better. And, of course, we're continually following up with them. We're sending them reminders. We're inviting them to webinars or seminars in our session, in our center, that reinforce what they learned.
How effective are the webinars?
Webinars are actually a very, very powerful tool. People don't have the desire to leave the place where they're comfortable in. So if they can do it from home, they can do it for their office. If it's short, it's 15 minutes, 30 minutes. It's very, very strong. And so once you take training, if you were to come to a training session, typically, Mike, mm-hmm. and you were to take, you know, something of interest for you, let's say you want to learn how to design a website.
Okay.
So you take two classes or whatever, a couple of days to design a website. And then you go off and you go back to the races. Well, what will happen is somebody will contact you to invite you to a session which will reinforce one of the foundation pieces and say, you know what, just log on this day at this time. For 30 minutes, we're going to walk you through what you learned already,
mm-hmm.
But we're going to remind you some of the details that really make more effective in real life, because you're never going to go back and read that book again if you can avoid it. So you'll say, hey, you know what, it's great because I was actually trying to work on my website and I couldn't remember how to do this or it was taking me longer than expected, and plus I'll get a chance to do some Q&A on some real life stuff that applies to me.
So your trainer is online conducting this webinar.
That's right.
With all the people who had gone to the classes.
That's right, exactly.
Let's say any of the consultants want to use webinars to train. What tools or software have you found that are real effective in doing that?
In part, it depends on your budget. There's very inexpensive tools like Convoke, C-O-N-V-O-Q, .com. They have a software called ASAP, a couple $100 a year. You can have up to 25 people on each session. You can do as many sessions as you want. Fairly inexpensive, not super feature-rich, but, you know, it will get most people by a one-way presentation where, you know, I'm presenting to you, you can see what I'm doing, you can see my screen, you can see my slides, put a website.
Can you run PowerPoint on it?
Yeah, you can run PowerPoint on it. Mm-hmm. So fairly effective. Now, if you need far more sophistication, far more power, I use WebEx a lot. But WebEx, you have to be spending some cash, and I think an organization is going to use it for, you know, 50 people, presentations, so on, consistently. You're looking at $8,000 or $10,000 a year. So you need to have some justification. Microsoft's live meeting is pretty strong, again, feature-rich, but more expensive. If you become creative, you can do session sharing with Microsoft Messenger. You know, if you learn to be sophisticated with that,
mm-hmm.
you can do some sharing of files and documents that way, too. When it comes to the web sessions, quality is important. In my opinion, if you use a weak tool that doesn't meet all the requirements you need and you don't practice doing it, you have to sit there, and if you're a one-man shop and sit your wife down across the table at another computer or at her office and have her listen to you doing it so that you nail it, because unfortunately you can't gauge your audience. You're making a lot of mistakes. If pages are hanging, if you don't know how to use it, you're going to come across really, really poor.
And how long did it take you to buy it out?
9 months.
Was he pretty surprised?
Yeah, he was. You know, he was quite excited about what had happened. But at the same time, you know, he sat back and he said, man, I wish I knew years ago what I know now about spending the time getting this business operating on autopilot and having processes and systems in place and policies and procedures that are actionable versus doing the way I'd done things in the past. So
that's just one business. Did you do the same thing with another business?
Yeah, I bought a carpet cleaner with the same process.
Tell me the story about that. This is great.
Very similar. Again, pretty fascinating. I actually have hired a person in my company about a year ago now who all he does is he looks for businesses for sale
mm-hmm.
in the newspaper. It's amazing how many people, you know, just finally get fed up of running their company. They've got great intellectual property. They might have invented something. They might have, in the case of this carpet cleaner, they slogged at it for years, and they did okay, made a living, you know, got by, and they say, you know, enough is enough. I'm going to work for somebody else, or I'm going to get into somebody else. Or they might have been smart, and instead of spending all the money they made, they put some stuff aside, and now can retire, right?
This is the end of Part 2 interview with Christian Cares. Please continue to Part 3. You may not know what barter is or what the trade industry is, but it's a tremendous, a multi-billion dollar industry, and I've come up with a loophole on how to take advantage of this industry and literally put thousands and thousands of dollars worth of savings into your pocket. You can hear me do it for real in this 15-minute recording. I will show you how I saved for personal expenses almost $10,000 with only about 15 minutes of telephone calls. I promise you, you've never heard anything like this, and instead of me telling you how to do it, I show you how. You can listen to me do it for real. So head on over to the product section at hardtofindseminars.com. In the light blue column on the left, click on the link that says Barter Secrets, and you can hear it all in action. I think you're going to find this fascinating.